swiftly. Ranyi, you should text and drive only when you are alone, so that you kill only yourself, Ifemelu said.
Haba! I don't text and drive, oh. I text when I'm not driving, she said. This wedding was something else, the best wedding I've been to.
I wonder if you'll remember the bride. She was Funke's very good friend in secondary school.
Ijoma, very yellow girl.
She went to Holy Child, but she used to come to our Wyatt lesson with Funke. We became friends in university.
If you see her now, eh? She's a serious babe. Her husband has major money. Her engagement ring is bigger than Zuma Rock.
Ifemelu stared out of the window, half listening, thinking how unpretty Lagos was. Roads infested with potholes, houses springing up unplanned like weeds. Of her jumble of feelings, she recognized only confusion.
Lime and peach, Ranyi Nudo said.
What?
The wedding colors. Lime and peach. The whole decoration was so nice, and the cake was just beautiful. Look, I took some pictures. I'm going to put this one up on Facebook.
Ranyi Nudo gave Ifemelu her BlackBerry. Ifemelu held on to it so that Ranyi Nudo would focus on her driving.
And I met someone who. He saw me when I was waiting outside for the mass to end. It was so hot. My foundation was melting on my face, and I know I looked like a zombie. But he still came to talk to me. That's a good sign. I think this one is serious husband material. Did I tell you my mother was saying novenas to end my relationship when I was dating Ibrahim? At least she will not have a heart attack with this one. His name is Ndudi. Cool name, Abby. You can't get more Igbo than that. And you should have seen his watch. He's into oil. His business card has Nigerian and international offices.
Why were you waiting outside during mass?
All the bridesmaids had to wait outside because our dresses were indecent.
Ranyi Nudo rolled indecent around her tongue and chuckled.
It happens all the time, especially in Catholic churches. We even had cover-ups, but the priest said they were too lazy, so we just waited outside until the mass ended. But thank God for that, or I would not have met this guy.
Ifemelu looked at Ranyi Nudo's dress, its thin straps, its pleated neckline that showed no cleavage. Before she left, were bridesmaids banished from church services because their dresses had spaghetti straps? She did not think so, but she was no longer sure. She was no longer sure what was new in Lagos and what was new in herself. Ranyi Nudo parked on a street in Lekki, which was bare reclaimed land when Ifemelu left, but now a cavalcade of large houses encircled by high walls.
My flat is the smallest, so I don't have a parking space inside, Ranyi Nudo said. The other tenants park inside, but you should see all the shouting that happens in the morning when somebody does not move their car out of the way or somebody else is late for work.
Ifemelu climbed out of the car and into the loud, discordant drone of generators. Too many generators. The sound pierced the soft middle of her ears and throbbed in her head.
No light for the past week, Ranyi Nudo said,
shouting to be heard above the generators. The gateman had hurried over to help with the suitcases.
Welcome back, auntie, he said to Ifemelu.
He had not merely said welcome, but welcome back, as though he knew somehow that she was truly back. She thanked him, and in the grey of the evening darkness, the air burdened with smells, she ached with an almost unbearable emotion that she could not name. It was nostalgic and melancholy, a beautiful sadness for the things she had missed and the things she would never know. Later, sitting on the couch in Ranyi Nudo's small, stylish living room, her feet sunk into the too soft carpet, the flat-screen TV perched on the opposite wall, Ifemelu looked unbelievingly at herself. She had done it. She had come back. She turned the TV on and searched for the Nigerian channels. On NTA, the First Lady, blue scarf wrapped around her face, was addressing a rally of women, and crawling around the screen were the words, "The First Lady is empowering women with mosquito nets."
I can't remember the last time I watched that stupid station, Ranyi Nudo said. They lie for the government, but they can't even lie well.
So which Nigerian channel do you watch?
I don't even really watch any. I watch Style and E, sometimes CNN and BBC.
Ranyi Nudo had changed into shorts and a T-shirt.
I have a girl who comes and cooks and cleans for me, but I made this stew myself because you were coming. So you must eat it too. What will you drink? I have malt and orange juice.
Malt! I'm going to drink all the malt in Nigeria. I used to buy it from a Hispanic supermarket in Baltimore,
but it was not the same thing. I ate really nice ofada rice at the wedding. I'm not hungry,
Ranyanuda said. But after she served Ifemelu's food on a dinner plate, she ate some rice and chicken stew from a plastic bowl, perched on the arm of the couch, while they gossiped about old friends. Priye was an event planner and had recently gone big time after being introduced to the governor's wife. Torchi had lost her job at a bank after the last bank crisis, but she had married a wealthy lawyer and had a baby.
Torchi used to tell me how much people had in their accounts,
Ranyanuda said.
Remember that guy, Mekus Parara, who was dying for Guinea? Remember how he always had smelly yellow patches under his arms? He has major money now, but it's dirty money. You know, all these guys who do fraud in London and America, then run back to Nigeria with the money and build mighty houses in Victoria Garden City. Torchi told me that he never came to the bank himself. He used to send his boys with Ghana Must Go bags to carry 10 million today, 20 million tomorrow. Me, I never wanted to work in a bank. The problem with working in a bank is that if you don't get a good branch with high net customers, you are finished. You'll spend all your time attending to useless traders. Torchi was lucky with her job, and she worked in a good branch, and she met her husband there. Do you want another malt?
Ranyanuda got up. There was a luxurious womanly slowness to her gait, a lift, a roll, a toggle of her buttocks with each step. A Nigerian walk. A walk, too, that hinted at excess, as though it spoke of something in need of toning down. Ifemelu took the cold bottle of malt from Ranyanuda and wondered if this would have been her life if she had not left, if she would be like Ranyanuda, working for an advertising company, living in a one-bedroom flat whose rent her salary could not pay, attending a Pentecostal church where she was an usher, and dating a married chief executive who bought her business-class tickets to London. Ranyanuda showed Ifemelu his photographs on her phone. In one, he was bare-chested, with a slight swell of a middle-aged belly, reclining on Ranyanudo's bed, smiling the bashful smile of a man just sated from sex. In another, he was looking down in a close-up shot, his face a blurred and mysterious silhouette. There was something attractive, even distinguished, about his grey speckled hair.
Is it me, or does he look like a tortoise?
Ifemelu said.
It's you. But Ifem, seriously, Don is a good man, not like many of these useless Lagos men running around town.
Ranyi, you told me it was just a passing thing, but 2 years is not a passing thing. I worry about you.
I have feelings for him, I won't deny it. But I want to marry, and he knows that. I used to think maybe I should have a child for him. But look at Uche Okafor. Remember her from Soka? She had a child for the managing director of Hale Bank, and the man told her to go to hell, that he was not the father, and now she's left raising a child alone, Nawa.
Ranyanuda was looking at the photograph on her phone with a faint, fond smile. Earlier on the drive back from the airport, she had said as she slowed down to sink into and then climb out of a large pothole,
I really want Don to change this car. He's been promising for the past 3 months. I need a jeep. Do you see how terrible the roads are?
And Ifemelu felt something between fascination and longing for Ranyanudo's life, a life in which she waved a hand and things fell from the sky, things that she quite simply expected should fall from the sky. At midnight, Ranyanuda turned off her generator and opened the windows.
I've been running this generator for one straight week, can you imagine? The light situation has not been this bad in a long time.
The coolness dissipated quickly. Warm, humid air gagged the room, and soon Ifemelu was tossing in the wetness of her own sweat. A painful throbbing had started behind her eyes, and a mosquito was buzzing nearby. And she felt suddenly, guiltily grateful that she had a blue American passport in her bag. It shielded her from choicelessness. She could always leave. She did not have to stay.
What kind of humidity is this? She said.
She was on Ranyanudo's bed, and Ranyanuda was on a mattress on the floor. I can't breathe.
I can't breathe,
Ranyanuda mimicked, her voice laughter-filled.
Haba Americana!
Chapter 45. Ifemelu had found the listing on Nigerian Jobs Online, features editor for Leading Women's Monthly Magazine. She edited her resume, invented past experience as a staff writer on a women's magazine,
folded due to bankruptcy, in parentheses, and days after she sent it off by courier, the publisher of Zoe called from Lagos. There was, about the mature, friendly voice on the other end of the line, a vague air of inappropriateness.
Oh, call me Auntie Onenu,
she said cheerfully, when Ifemelu asked who was speaking. Before she offered Ifemelu the job, she said, tone hushed in confidence,
my husband did not support me when I started this, because he thought men would chase me if I went to seek advertising.
Ifemelu sensed that the magazine was a hobby for Auntie Onenu, a hobby that meant something, but still a hobby, not a passion, not something that consumed her. And when she met Auntie Onenu, she felt this more strongly. Here was a woman easy to like, but difficult to take seriously. Ifemelu went with Ranyinudo to Auntie Onenu's home in Ikoyi. They sat on leather sofas that felt cold to the touch, and talked in low voices until Auntie Onenu appeared. A slim, smiling, well-preserved woman, wearing leggings, a large T-shirt, and an overly youthful weave, the wavy hair trailing all the way to her back.
My new features editor has come from America,
she said, hugging Ifemelu. It was difficult to tell her age, anything between 50 and 65, but it was easy to tell that she had not been born with her light complexion. Its sheen was too waxy, and her knuckles were dark, as though those folds of skin had valiantly resisted her bleaching cream.
I wanted you to come around before you start on Monday so I can welcome you personally,
Auntie Onenu said. Thank you. Ifemelu thought the home visit unprofessional and odd, but this was a small magazine, and this was Nigeria, where boundaries were blurred, where work blended into life, and bosses were called mummy. Besides, she already imagined taking over the running of Zoe, turning it into a vibrant, relevant companion for Nigerian women, and, who knew, perhaps one day buying out Auntie Onenu. And she would not welcome new recruits in her home.
You are a pretty girl,
Auntie Onenu said, nodding, as though being pretty were needed for the job, and she had worried that Ifemelu might not be.
I liked how you sounded on the phone. I'm sure with you on board, our circulation will soon surpass glass. You know we are a much younger publication, but already catching up to them.
A steward in white, a grave elderly man, emerged to ask what they would drink. Auntie Onenu, I've been reading back issues of both Glass and Zoe, and I have some ideas about what we can do differently, Ifemelu said, after the steward left to get their orange juice.
You are a real American, ready to get to work, a no-nonsense person. Very good. First of all, tell me how you think we compare to Glass.
Ifemelu had thought both magazines vapid, but Glass was better edited. The page colors did not bleed as badly as they did in Zoe, and it was more visible in traffic. Whenever Ranyinudo's car slowed, there was a hawker pressing a copy of Glass against her window, but because she could already see Auntie Onenu's obsession with a competition, so nakedly personal, she said,
It's about the same, but I think we can do better. We need to cut down the profile interviews and do just one a month, and profile a woman who has actually achieved something real on her own. We need more personal columns, and we should introduce a rotating guest column and do more health and money. Have a stronger online presence. And stop lifting foreign magazine pieces. Most of your readers can't go into the market and buy broccoli because we don't have it in Nigeria. So why does this month Zoe have a recipe for cream of broccoli soup?
Yes, yes,
Auntie Onenu said slowly. She seemed astonished. Then, as though recovering herself, she said,
Very good. We'll discuss all this on Monday.
In the car, Ranyinudo said,
Talking to your new boss like that?
Ha! If you had not come from America, she would have fired you immediately.
I wonder what the story is between her and the Glass publisher.
I read in one of the tabloids that they hate each other. I am sure it is man trouble. What else? Women. Eh! I think Auntie Onenu started Zoe just to compete with Glass. As far as I'm concerned, she's not a publisher. She's just a rich woman who's decided to start a magazine, and tomorrow she might close it and start a spa.
And what an ugly house, Ifemelu said. It was monstrous, with two alabaster angels guarding the gate, and a dome-shaped fountain sputtering in the front yard.
Ugly? Quah! What are you talking about? The house is beautiful.
Not to me, Ifemelu said. and yet she had once found houses like that beautiful. But here she was now, disliking it with the haughty confidence of a person who recognized kitsch.
"Her generator is as big as my flat, and is completely noiseless,"
Rani Nudo said.
"Do you notice the generator house on the side of the gate?"
Ifemelo had not noticed, and it piqued her. This was what a true Lagosian should have noticed. The generator house, the generator size. On Kingsway Road, she thought she saw Binze drive past in a low-slung black Mercedes, and she sat up, straining and peering, but slowed at a traffic jam. She saw that the man looked nothing like him. There were other imagined glimpses of Obinze over the next weeks. People she knew were not him, but could have been. The straight-backed figure in a suit walking into Auntie Onenu's office. The man in the back of a car with tinted windows, his face bent to a phone. The figure behind her in the supermarket line. She even imagined, when she first went to meet her landlord, that she would walk in and discover Obinze sitting there. The estate agent had told her that the landlord preferred expatriate renters.
"But he relaxed when I told him you came from America,"
he added. The landlord was an elderly man in a brown caftan and matching trousers. He had the weathered skin and wounded air of one who had endured much at the hands of others.
"I do not rent to Ibok people," he said, softly startling her.
Were such things now said so easily? Had they been said so easily, and had she merely forgotten?
"That is my policy, since one Igbo man destroyed my house at Yaba. But you look like a responsible somebody."
"Yes, I am responsible," she said, and feigned a simpering smile. The other flats she liked were too expensive. Even though pipes poked out under the kitchen sink, and the toilet was lopsided, and the bathroom tiles shoddily laid, this was the best she could afford. She liked the airiness of the living room, with its large windows, and the narrow flight of stairs that led to a tiny veranda charmed her. But most of all, it was in Ikoyi, and she wanted to live in Ikoyi. Growing up, Ikoyi had reeked of gentility, a faraway gentility that she could not touch. The people who lived in Ikoyi had faces free of pimples, and drivers designated the children's driver. The first day she saw the flat, she stood on the veranda and looked across at the compound next door, a grand colonial house, now yellowed from decay, the ground swallowed in foliage, grass and shrubs climbing atop one another. On the roof of the house, a part of which had collapsed and sunk in, she saw a movement, a turquoise splash of feathers. It was a peacock. The estate agent told her that an army officer had lived there during General Abacha's regime. Now the house was tied up in court, and she imagined the people who had lived there 15 years ago, while she, in a little flat on the crowded mainland, longed for their spacious, serene lives. She wrote the check for 2 years' rent. This was why people took bribes and asked for bribes. How else could anyone honestly pay 2 years' rent in advance? She planned to fill her veranda with white lilies in clay pots and decorate her living room in pastels, but first, she had to find an electrician to install air conditioners, a painter to redo the oily walls, and somebody to lay new tiles in the kitchen and bathroom. The estate agent brought a man who did tiles. It took him a week, and when the estate agent called her to say that the work was done, she went eagerly to the flat. In the bathroom she stared in disbelief. The tile edges were rough, tiny spaces gaping at the corners. One tile had an ugly crack across the middle. It looked like something done by an impatient child.
"What is this nonsense? Look at how rough this is. One tile is broken. This is even worse than the old tiles. How can you be happy with this useless work?"
she asked the man. He shrugged. He clearly thought she was making unnecessary trouble.
"I am happy with the work, auntie." "You want me to pay you?"
A small smile.
"Ah, auntie, but I have finished the work."
The estate agent intervened.
"Don't worry, ma. He will repair the broken one."
The tile man looked reluctant.
"But I have finished the work. The problem is the tile is breaking very easily. It is the quality of tile."
"You have finished? You do this rubbish job and you say you have finished?" Her anger was growing, her voice rising and hardening.
"I will not pay you what we agreed. No way, because you have not done what we agreed."
The tile man was staring at her, eyes narrowed.
"And if you want trouble, trust me, you will get it,"
Ifemelu said.
The first thing I will do is call the commissioner of police and they will lock you up in Alagbong Close.
She was screaming now.
Do you know who I am? You don't know who I am. That is why you can't do this kind of rubbish work for me.
The man looked cowed. She had surprised herself. Where had that come from? The false bravado, the easy resort to threats. A memory came to her, undiminished after so many years, of the day Auntie Uju's general died. How Auntie Uju had threatened his relatives.
No, don't go. Just stay there,
she had said to them.
Stay there while I go and call my boys from the army barracks.
The estate agent said, Auntie, don't worry. He will do the work again. Later, Ranyanudo told her,
You are no longer behaving like an Americana.
And despite herself, Ifemelu felt pleased to hear this.
The problem is that we no longer have artisans in this country,
Ranyanudo said.
Ghanaians are better. My boss is building a house and he's using only Ghanaians to do his finishing. Nigerians will do rubbish for you. They do not take their time to finish things properly. It's terrible. But Ifem, you should have called Ominze. He would have sorted everything out for you. This is what he does after all. He must have all kinds of contacts. You should have called him before you even started looking for a flat. He could have given you reduced rent in one of his properties. Even a free flat, sis. I don't know what you are waiting for before you call him.
Ifemelu shook her head. Ranyanudo, for whom men existed only as sources of things, she could not imagine calling Obinze to ask him for reduced rent in one of his properties. Still, she did not know why she had not called him at all. She had thought of it many times, often bringing out her phone to scroll to his number, and yet she had not called. He still sent emails, saying he hoped she was fine, or he hoped Dike was doing better, and she replied to a few, always briefly. Replies, he would assume, were sent from America. Chapter 46 She spent weekends with her parents, in the old flat, happy simply to sit and look at the walls that had witnessed her childhood. Only when she began to eat her mother's stew, an oil layer floating on top of the pureed tomatoes, did she realize how much she had missed it. The neighbors stopped by to greet her, the daughter back from America. Many of them were new and unfamiliar, but she felt a sentimental fondness for them because they reminded her of the others she had known. Mama Bomboy downstairs, who had once pulled her ear when she was in primary school and said,
You do not greet your elders.
Oga Tony upstairs, who smoked on his veranda. The trader next door who called her for reasons she never knew.
Champion.
They are just coming to see if you will give them anything, her mother said, in a whisper, as if the neighbors who had all left might overhear. They all expect me to buy something for them when we went to America. So I went to the market and bought small, small bottles of perfume and told them it was from America.
Her parents liked to talk about their visit to Baltimore, her mother about the sales, her father about how he could not understand the news because Americans now used expressions like divvy up and nuke in serious news.
It is the final infantilization and informalization of America. It portends the end of the American empire, and they are killing themselves from within,
he pronounced. Ifemelu humored them, listening to their observations and memories, and hoped that neither of them would bring up Blaine. She had told them a work issue had delayed his visit. She did not have to lie to her old friends about Blaine, but she did, telling them she was in a serious relationship and he would join her in Lagos soon. It surprised her how quickly, during reunions with old friends, the subject of marriage came up, a waspish tone in the voices of the unmarried, a smugness in those of the married. Ifemelu wanted to talk about the past, about the teachers they had mocked, and the boys they had liked, but marriage was always the preferred topic. Whose husband was a dog, who was on a desperate prowl, posting too many dressed-up pictures of herself on Facebook, whose man had disappointed her after 4 years and left her to marry a small girl he could control. When Ifemelu told Ranyanudo that she had run into an old classmate Vivian at the bank, Ranyanudo's first question was, Is she married? And so she used Blaine as armor. If they knew of Blaine, then the married friends would not tell her, Don't worry, your own will come, just pray about it. And the unmarried friends would not assume that she was a member of the self-pity party of the single. There was also a strange nostalgia in those reunions, some in Ranyanudo's flat, some in hers, some in restaurants,
because she struggled to find in these adult women some remnants from her past that were often no longer there. Tochi was unrecognizable now, so fat that even her nose had changed shape, her double chin hanging below her face like a bread roll. She came to Ifemelu's flat with her baby in one hand, her blackberry in the other, and a house help trailing behind, holding a canvas bag full of bottles and bibs.
Madame America, was Tochi's greeting,
and then she spoke for the rest of her visit, in defensive spurts, as though she had come determined to battle Ifemelu's Americanness.
I buy only British clothes for my baby, because American ones fade after one wash, she said. My husband wanted us to move to America, but I refused, because the education system is so bad. An international agency rated it the lowest in the developed countries, you know?
Tochi had always been perceptive and thoughtful. It was Tochi who had intervened with calm reason whenever Ifemelu and Rani Nudo argued in secondary school. In Tochi's changed persona, in her need to defend against imagined slights, Ifemelu saw a great personal unhappiness. And so she appeased Tochi, putting America down, talking only about the things she too disliked about America, exaggerating her non-American accent until the conversation became an enervating charade. Finally, Tochi's baby vomited, a yellowish liquid that the house help hastily wiped, and Tochi said, "We should go. Baby wants to sleep." Ifemelu, relieved, watched her leave. People changed. Sometimes they changed too much. Priye had not changed so much as hardened, her personality coated in chrome. She arrived at Ranyanudo's flat with a pile of newspapers, full of photographs of the big wedding she had just planned. Ifemelu imagined how people would talk about Priye. "She is doing well," they would say. "She is really doing well."
"My phone has not stopped ringing since last week," Priye said triumphantly,
pushing back the auburn straight weave that fell across one eye. Each time she raised a hand to push back the hair, which invariably fell back again across her eyes since it had been sewn in to do so, Ifemelu was distracted by the brittle pink colour of her nails. Priye had the sure, slightly sinister manner of someone who could get other people to do what she wanted. And she glittered. Her sparkly yellow-gold earrings, the metal studs on her designer bag, the sparkly bronze lipstick.
"It was a very successful wedding. We had 7 governors in attendance." "7," she said.
"And none of them knew the couple, I'm sure," Ifemelu said dryly.
Priye gestured, a shrug, an upward flick of her palm, to show how irrelevant that was.
"Since when has the success of weddings been measured by how many governors attend?" Ifemelu asked.
"It shows you're connected. It shows prestige. Do you know how powerful governors in this country are? Executive power is not a small thing," Priye said.
"Me? I want as many governors as possible to come to my own wedding. It shows levels, serious levels," Ranyanudo said.
She was studying the photographs, turning the newspaper pages slowly.
"Priye, you heard Mosope is getting married in 2 weeks."
"Yes, she approached me, but their budget was too small for me. That girl never understood the first rule of life in this Lagos. You do not marry the man you love. You marry the man who can best maintain you."
"Amen," Ranyanudo said, laughing. "But sometimes one man can be both, though. This is the seasons of weddings. When will it be my turn, Father Lord?"
She glanced upwards, raising her hands as though in prayer.
"I've told Ranyanudo that I'll do her wedding at no commission," Priye said to Ifemelu. "And I'll do yours too, Ifem."
"Thank you, but I think Blaine will prefer a governor-free event," Ifemelu said,
and they all laughed.
"We'll probably do something small on a beach."
Sometimes she believed her own lies. She could see it now, she and Blaine wearing white on a beach in the Caribbean, surrounded by a few friends, running to a makeshift altar of sand and flowers, and Shan watching and hoping one of them would trip and fall. Chapter 47
Onikon was the old Lagos, a slice of the past, a temple to the faded splendour of the colonial years. Ifemelu remembered how houses here had sagged, unpainted and untended, and mould crept up the walls, and gate hinges rusted and atrophied. But developers were renovating and dismantling now, and on the ground floor of a newly refurbished 3-storey building,
Heavy glass doors opened into a reception area, painted a terracotta orange, where a pleasant-faced receptionist, Esther, sat, and behind her loomed giant words in silver, Zoe Magazine. Esther was full of small ambitions. If Emelu imagined her combing through the piles of second-hand shoes and clothes in the side stalls of Chejosho Market, finding the best pieces and then haggling tirelessly with the trader. She wore neatly pressed clothes and scuffed but carefully polished high heels, read books like Praying Your Way to Prosperity, and was superior with the drivers and ingratiating with the editors.
"This your earring is very fine, Ma," she said to Ifemelu. "If you ever want to throw it away, please give it to me to help you throw it away."
And she ceaselessly invited Ifemelu to her church.
"Will you come this Sunday, Ma? My pastor is a powerful man of God. So many people have testimonies of miracles that have happened in their lives because of him."
"Why do you think I need to come to your church, Esther?"
"You'll like it, Ma. It is a spirit-filled church."
At first, the Ma had made Ifemelu uncomfortable. Esther was at least 5 years older than she was, but status, of course, surpassed age. She was the features editor, with a car and a driver, and the spirit of America hanging over her head. And even Esther expected her to play the madam. And so she did, complimenting Esther and joking with Esther, but always in that manner that was both playful and patronizing, and sometimes giving Esther things, an old handbag, an old watch, just as she did with her driver, Ayo. She complained about his speeding, threatened to fire him for being late again, asked him to repeat her instructions to make sure he had understood. Yet she always heard the unnatural high pitch of her voice when she said these things, unable to fully convince even herself of her own madamness. Auntie Onenu liked to say, "Most of my staff are foreign graduates, while the women at Glass hire riffraff who cannot punctuate sentences." Ifemelu imagined her saying this at a dinner party. "Most of my staff," making the magazine sound like a large, busy operation, although it was an editorial staff of three, an administrative staff of four, and only Ifemelu and Doris, the editor, had foreign degrees. Doris, thin and hollow-eyed, a vegetarian who announced that she was a vegetarian as soon as she possibly could, spoke with a teenage American accent that made her sentences sound like questions, except for when she was speaking to her mother on the phone. Then her English took on a flat, stolid Nigerianness. Her long sister locks were sun-bleached a coppery tone, and she dressed unusually, white socks and brogues, men's shirts tucked into pedal pushers, which she considered original, and which everyone in the office forgave her for, because she had come back from abroad. She wore no makeup except for bright red lipstick, and it gave her face a certain shock value, that slash of crimson, which was probably her intent. But her unadorned skin tended towards ashy grey, and Ifemelu's first urge when they met was to suggest a good moisturiser.
"You went to Wellson in Philly? I went to Temple," Doris said, as though to establish right away that they were members of the same superior club. "You're going to be sharing this office with me and Zemaye. She's the assistant editor, and she's out on assignment until this afternoon, or maybe longer. She always stays as long as she wants."
Ifemelu caught the malice. It was not subtle. Doris had meant for it to be caught.
"I thought you could, like, just spend this week getting used to things, see what we do, and then next week you can start some assignments," Doris said.
"Okay," Ifemelu said. The office itself, a large room with four desks, on each of which sat a computer, looked bare and untested, as though it was everybody's first day at work. Ifemelu was not sure what would make it look otherwise. Perhaps pictures of family on the desks, or just more things, more files and papers and staplers, proof of its being inhabited.
"I had a great job in New York, but I decided to move back and settle down here," Doris said. "Like, family pressure to settle down and stuff, you know? Like I'm the only daughter. When I first got back, one of my aunts looked at me and said, 'I can get you a job at a good bank, but you have to cut off that dada hair.'"
She shook her head from side to side in mockery, as she mimicked a Nigerian accent.
"I swear to God, this city is full of banks that just want you to be reasonably attractive in a kind of predictable way, and you have a job in customer service. Anyway, I took this job because I'm interested in the magazine business, and this is like a good place to meet people because of all the events we get to go to, you know?"
Doris sounded as if she and Ifemelu
somehow shared the same plot, the same view of the world. Ifemelu felt a small resentment at this, the arrogance of Doris's certainty that she, too, would of course feel the same way as Doris. Just before lunchtime, into the office walked a woman in a tight pencil skirt and patent shoes high as stilts, her straightened hair sleekly pulled back. She was not pretty. Her facial features created no harmony, but she carried herself as though she was. Nubile. She made Ifemelu think of that word, with her shapely slenderness, her tiny waist, and the unexpected high curves of her breasts.
Hi. You're Ifemelu, right? Welcome to Zoe. I'm Zemaye.
She shook Ifemelu's hand, her face carefully neutral.
Hi, Zemaye. It's nice to meet you. You have a lovely name, Ifemelu said.
Thank you. She was used to hearing it. I hope you don't like cold rooms.
Cold rooms?
Yes. Doris likes to put the AC on too high, and I have to wear a sweater in the office. But now that you're here sharing the office, maybe we can vote,
Zemaye said, settling down at her desk.
What are you talking about? Since when do you have to wear a sweater in the office?
Doris asked. Zemaye raised her eyebrows and pulled out a thick shawl from her drawer.
It's the humidity that's just so crazy,
Doris said, turning to Ifemelu, expecting agreement.
I felt like I couldn't breathe when I first came back.
Zemaye, too, turned to Ifemelu.
I am a Delta girl, homemade, born and bred, so I did not grow up with air conditioners, and I can breathe without a room being cold.
She spoke in an impassive tone, and everything she said was delivered evenly, never rising or falling.
Well, I don't know about cold, Doris said. Most offices in Lagos have air conditioners.
Not tuned to the lowest temperature, Zemaye said.
You never said anything about it.
I tell you all the time, Doris.
I mean, did it actually prevent you from working?
It's cold, full stop, Zemaye said.
Their mutual dislike was a smoldering, stalking leopard in the room.
I don't like cold, Ifemelu said. I think I would freeze if the AC was turned on to the lowest.
Doris blinked. She looked not merely betrayed, but surprised that she had been betrayed.
Well, okay. We can turn it off and on throughout the day. I have a hard time breathing without the AC, and the windows are so damn small.
Okay, Ifemelu said.
Zemaye said nothing. She had turned to her computer, as though indifferent to this small victory. And Ifemelu felt unaccountably disappointed. She had taken sides, after all, boldly standing with Zemaye, and yet Zemaye remained expressionless, hard to read. Ifemelu wondered what her story was. Zemaye intrigued her. Later, Doris and Zemaye were looking over photographs spread out on Doris's table of a portly woman wearing tight ruffled clothes when Zemaye said,
"Excuse me, I'm pressed," and hurried to the door, her supple movements making Ifemelu want to lose weight.
Doris's eyes followed her, too.
Don't you just hate it how people say I'm pressed or I want to ease myself when they want to go to the bathroom?
Doris asked.
Ifemelu laughed.
I know.
I guess bathroom is very American, but there's toilet, restroom, the ladies.
I never liked the ladies. I like toilet.
Me too, Doris said. And don't you just hate it when people here use on as a verb? On the light?
You know what I can't stand? When people say take instead of drink. I will take wine. I don't take beer.
Oh, God, I know.
They were laughing when Zemaye came back in, and she looked at Ifemelu with her eerily neutral expression and said,
"You people must be discussing the next Bintu meeting."
"What's that?" Ifemelu asked.
"Doris talks about them all the time, but she can't invite me because it is only for people who have come from abroad."
If there was mockery in Zemaye's tone, and there had to be, she kept it under her flat delivery.
"Oh, please. Bintu is, like, so outdated. This is not 1960,
Doris said.
Then to Ifemelu, she said,
"I was actually going to tell you about it. It's called the Nigerpolitan Club, and it's just a bunch of people who have recently moved back, some from England, but most from the U.S. Really low-key, just like sharing experiences and networking. I bet you'll know some of the people." You should totally come.
Yes, I'd like to. Doris got up and took her hand back.
I have to go to Auntie Onenu's house.
After she left, the room was silent, Zamaye typing at her computer, Ifemelu browsing the internet and wondering what Zamaye was thinking. Finally, Zamaye said, "So, you were a famous race blogger in America. When Auntie Onenu told us, I didn't understand." "What do you mean?"
"Why race?"
"I discovered race in America and it fascinated me."
"Hmm,"
Zamaye murmured, as though she thought this, discovering race, an exotic and self-indulgent phenomenon.
"Auntie Onenu said your boyfriend is a black American and he's coming soon."
Ifemelu was surprised. Auntie Onenu had asked about her personal life with a casualness that was also insistent, and she had told her the false story of Blaine, thinking that her boss had no business with her personal life anyway, and now it seemed that personal life had been shared with other staff. Perhaps she was being too American about it, fixating on privacy for its own sake. What did it really matter if Zamaye knew of Blaine?
"Yes, he should be here by next month," she said.
"Why is it only black people that are criminals over there?"
Ifemelu opened her mouth and closed it. Here she was, famous race blogger, and she was lost for words.
"I love cops. It's because of that show that I have DSTV, Zamaye said, "and all the criminals are black people."
"It's like saying every Nigerian is a 419,
Ifemelu said finally. She sounded too limp, too insufficient.
"But it's true. All of us have small 419 in our blood."
Zamaye smiled with what seemed to be, for the first time, a real amusement in her eyes. Then she added,
"Sorry, you. I did not mean that your boyfriend is a criminal. I was just asking."
Chapter 48. Ifemelu asked Ranyinudo to come with her and Doris to the Nigerpolitan meeting.
"I don't have energy for you returnees, please," Ranyinudo said. "Besides, Ndudi is finally back from all his traveling up and down, and we're going out."
"Good luck choosing a man over your friend, you witch."
"Yes, so. Are you the person that will marry me? Meanwhile, I told Don I'm going out with you, so make sure you don't go anywhere that he might go."
Ranyinudo was laughing. She was still seeing Don, waiting to make sure that Ndudi was serious before she stopped. And she hoped, too, that Don would get her the new car before then. The Nigerpolitan Club meeting, a small cluster of people drinking champagne in paper cups at the poolside of a home in Osborne Estate. Chic people, all dripping with savoir-faire, each nursing a self-styled quirkiness. A ginger-coloured afro, a T-shirt with a graphic of Thomas Sankara, oversized handmade earrings that hung like pieces of modern art. Their voices burred with foreign accents.
"You can't find a decent smoothie in this city."
"Oh my God, were you at that conference? What this country needs is an active civil society."
Ifemelu knew some of them. She chatted with Bisola and Yagazie, both of whom had natural hair worn in a twist-out, a halo of spirals framing their faces. They talked about hair salons here, where the hairdressers struggled and fumbled to comb natural hair, as though it were an alien eruption, as though their own hair was not the same way before it was defeated by chemicals.
"The salon girls are always like, 'Auntie, you don't want to relax your hair.' It's ridiculous that Africans don't value our natural hair in Africa," Yagazie said.
"I know," Ifemelu said, and she caught the righteousness in her voice, in all their voices. They were the sanctified, the returnees, back home with an extra gleaming layer. Ikenna joined them, a lawyer who had lived outside Philadelphia and whom she had met at a Blogging While Brown convention. And Fred joined them, too. He had introduced himself to Ifemelu earlier, a pudgy, well-groomed man.
"I lived in Boston until last year," he said in a falsely low-key way, because Boston was code for Harvard. Otherwise he would say MIT or Tufts or anywhere else.
Just as another woman said,
"I was in New Haven," in that coy manner that pretended not to be coy, which meant that she had been at Yale.
Other people joined them, all encircled by a familiarity,
because they could reach so easily for the same references. Soon they were laughing and listing the thing they missed about America.
Low-fat soya milk. NPR. Fast internet, Ifemelu said.
Good customer service. Good customer service. Good customer service,
Bisola said.
Folks here behave as though they are doing you a favor by serving you. The high-end places are okay, not great, but the regular restaurants? Forget it. The other day, I asked a waiter if I could get boiled yam with a different sauce than was on the menu, and he just looked at me and said, no. Hilarious.
But the American customer service can be so annoying. Someone hovering around and bothering you all the time? Are you still working on that? Since when did eating become work?
Yagazie said.
I miss a decent vegetarian place,
Doris said, and then talked about her new househelp, who could not make a simple sandwich, about how she'd ordered a vegetarian spring roll at a restaurant in Victoria Island, bit in, and tasted chicken, and the waiter, when summoned, just smiled and said, maybe they put chicken today.
There was laughter. Fred said a good vegetarian place would open soon, now that there was so much new investment in the country. Somebody would figure out that there was a vegetarian market to cater to.
A vegetarian restaurant? Impossible. There are only 4 vegetarians in this country, including Doris, Bisola said. You're not vegetarian, are you?
Fred asked Ifemelu. He just wanted to talk to her. She had looked up from time to time to find his eyes on her. No, she said.
Oh, there's this new place that opened on Akin Adesola, Bisola said. The brunch is really good. They have the kinds of things we can eat. We should go next Sunday.
They have the kinds of things we can eat. An unease crept up on Ifemelu. She was comfortable here, and she wished she were not. She wished, too, that she was not so interested in this new restaurant, did not perk up, imagining fresh green salads and steamed, still firm vegetables. She loved eating all the things she had missed while away. Jollof rice cooked with a lot of oil, fried plantains, boiled yams. But she longed also for other things she had become used to in America, even quinoa, Blaine's speciality, made with feta and tomatoes. This was what she hoped she had not become, but feared that she had.
They have the kinds of things we can eat, kind of person.
Fred was talking about Nollywood, speaking a little too loudly.
Nollywood is really public theatre. And if you understand it like that, then it is more tolerable. It's for public consumption, even mass participation, not the kind of individual experience that film is.
He was looking at her, soliciting her agreement with his eyes. They were not supposed to watch Nollywood, people like them, and if they did, then only as amusing anthropology.
I like Nollywood, Ifemelu said, even though she too thought Nollywood was more theatre than film. The urge to be contrarian was strong. If she set herself apart, perhaps she would be less of the person she feared she had become.
Nollywood may be melodramatic, but life in Nigeria is very melodramatic.
Really? The New Haven woman said, squeezing her paper cup in her hand, as though she thought it a great oddity that a person at this gathering would like Nollywood.
It is so offensive to my intelligence. I mean, the products are just bad. What does it say about us?
But Hollywood makes equally bad movies. They just make them with better lighting, Ifemelu said.
Fred laughed, too heartily, to let her know he was on her side.
It's not just about the technical stuff, the New Haven woman said. The industry is regressive. I mean, the portrayal of women. The films are more misogynistic than the society.
Ifemelu saw a man across the pool, whose wide shoulders reminded her of Obinze. But he was too tall to be Obinze. She wondered what Obinze would make of a gathering like this. Would he even come? He had been deported from England after all, so perhaps he would not consider himself a returnee like them.
Hey, come back,
Fred said, moving closer to her, claiming personal space.
Your mind isn't here.
She smiled thinly. It is now. Fred knew things. He had the confidence of a person who knew practical things. He probably had a Harvard MBA and used words like capacity and value in conversation. He would not dream in imagery, but in facts and figures.
There's a concert tomorrow at Muzan,
Do you like classical music?
He asked. No. She had not expected that he would either.
Are you willing to like classical music?
Willing to like something? It's a strange idea, she said, now curious about him, vaguely interested in him. They talked. Fred mentioned Stravinsky and Strauss, Vermeer and Van Dyck, making unnecessary references, quoting too often. His spirits attuned across the Atlantic, too transparent in his performance, too eager to show how much he knew of the Western world. Ifemelu listened with a wide internal yawn. She had been wrong about him. He was not the MBA type who thought the world was a business. He was an impresario, well-oiled and well-practiced, the sort of man who did a good American accent and a good British accent, who knew what to say to foreigners, how to make foreigners comfortable, and who could easily get foreign grants for dubious projects. She wondered what he was like beneath that practiced layer.
"So, will you come for this drink thing?"
he asked. "I'm exhausted," she said. "I think I'll head home, but call me." Chapter 49. The speedboat was gliding on foamy water, past beaches of ivory sand and trees a bursting, well-fed green. Ifemelu was laughing. She caught herself in mid-laughter and looked at her present. An orange life jacket strapped around her, a ship in the graying distance, her friends in their sunglasses, on their way to Priye's friend's beach house, where they would grill meat and race barefoot. She thought, "I'm really home. I'm home." She no longer sent Ranyanudo text about what to do. Should I buy meat in Shoprite, or send Diabo to the market? Where should I buy hangers? Now she awoke to the sound of the peacocks, and got out of bed, with the shape of her day familiar and her routines unthinking. She had signed up at a gym, but had gone only twice, because after work she preferred to meet her friends, and even though she always planned not to eat, she ended up eating a club sandwich and drinking one or two Chapmans, and then she would decide to postpone the gym. Her clothes felt even tighter now. Somewhere, in a faraway part of her mind, she wanted to lose weight before she saw Obinze again. She had not called him. She would wait until she was back to her slender self. At work, she felt an encroaching restlessness. Zoe stifled her. It was like wearing a scratchy sweater in the cold. She longed to yank it off, but was afraid of what would happen if she did. She thought often of starting a blog, writing about what she cared about, building it up slowly, and finally publishing her own magazine. But it was nebulous, too much of an unknown. Having this job, now that she was home, made her feel anchored. At first, she had enjoyed doing the features, interviewing society women in their homes, observing their lives and relearning old subtleties. But she soon became bored, and she would sit through the interviews, half listening, half present. Each time she walked into their cemented compounds, she longed for sand in which to curl her toes. A servant or child would let her in, seat her in a living room of leather and marble that brought to mind a clean airport in a wealthy country. Then Madame would appear, warm and good-humoured, offering her a drink, sometimes food, before settling on a sofa to talk. All of them, the Madame she interviewed, boasted about what they owned, and where they or their children had been, and what they had done, and then they capped their boasts with God.
"We thank God. It is God that did it. God is faithful."
Ifemelu thought as she left that she could write the features without doing the interviews. She could also cover events without attending them. How common that word was in Lagos, and how popular. Event. It could be a product rebranding, a fashion show, an album launch. Aunt Onenu always insisted that an editor go with the photographer.
"Please make sure you mingle,"
Aunt Onenu said.
"If they are not advertising with us yet, we want them to start. If they have started, we want them to increase."
To Ifemelu, Auntie Onenu said, "mingle," with great emphasis, as though this was something she thought Ifemelu did not do well. Perhaps Auntie Onenu was right. At those events, in halls aflame with balloons, rolls of silky cloth draped in corners, chairs covered in gauze, and too many ushers walking around, their faces gaudily bright with makeup,
Ifemelu disliked talking to strangers about Zoe. She would spend her time exchanging text with Ranyinudo, or Priye, or Zemaye, bored, waiting until when it would not be impolite to leave. There were always two or three meandering speeches, and all of them seemed written by the same verbose, insincere person. The wealthy and the famous were recognized.
"We wish to recognize in our presence the former governor of..."
Bottles were uncorked, juice cartons folded open, samosas and chicken satays served. Once, at an event she attended with Zemaye, the launch of a new beverage brand, she thought she saw Obinze walk past. She turned. It was not him, but it very well could have been. She imagined him attending events like this, in halls like this, with his wife by his side. Ranyinudo had told her that his wife, when she was a student, was voted the most beautiful girl at the University of Lagos, and in Ifemelu's imagination she looked like Bianca Ono, that beauty icon of her teenage years, high-cheekboned and almond-eyed. And when Ranyinudo mentioned his wife's name, Kusiso Chukwu, an uncommon name, Ifemelu imagined Obinze's mother asking her to translate it. The thought of Obinze's mother and Obinze's wife deciding which translation was better, God's will, or as it pleases God, felt like a betrayal. That memory of Obinze's mother saying, "Translate it," all those years ago, seemed even more precious now that she had passed away. As Ifemelu was leaving the event, she saw Don.
"Ifemelu," he said.
It took her a moment to recognize him. Ranyinudo had introduced them one afternoon months ago, when Don dropped by Ranyinudo's flat on his way to his club, wearing tennis whites, and Ifemelu had left almost immediately to give them privacy. He looked dapper in a navy suit, his grey sprinkled hair burnished. "Good evening," she said.
"You're looking well, very well," he said,
taking in her low-cut cocktail dress. "Thank you."
"You don't ask about me."
As though there was a reason for her to ask about him. He gave her his card.
"Call me. Make sure you call me, eh? Let's talk. Take care."
He was not interested in her, not particularly. He was simply a big man in Lagos, she attractive and alone, and by the laws of their universe, he had to make a pass, even if a half-hearted pass, even if he was already dating her friend. And he expected, of course, that she would not tell her friend. She slipped his card into her bag, and back home, tore it into tiny bits which she watched float in the toilet water for a while, before flushing. She was strangely angry with him. His action said something about her friendship with Ranyinudo that she disliked. She called Ranyinudo, and was about to tell her what happened, when Ranyinudo said,
"Ifem, I'm so depressed."
And so Ifemelu merely listened. "It was about Ndudi. He's such a child," Ranyinudo said.
"If you say something he doesn't like, he will stop talking and start humming. Seriously, humming. Loud humming. How does a grown man behave so immaturely?"
It was Monday morning. Ifemelu was reading Post Bourgie, her favorite American blog. Zemaye was looking through a stash of glossy photographs. Doris was staring at her computer screen, cradling in her palms a mug that said, "I heart Florida." On her desk, next to her computer, was a tin of loose-leaf tea.
"Ifemelu, I think this feature is too snarky."
"Your editorial feedback is priceless," Ifemelu said. "What does snarky mean? Please explain to some of us who did not go to school in America," Zemaye said. Doris ignored her completely.
"I just don't think Auntie Onena will want us to run this."
"Convince her. You're her editor," Ifemelu said. "We need to get this magazine going." Doris shrugged and got up.
"We'll talk about it at the meeting."
"I am so sleepy," Zemaye said. "I'm going to send Esther to make Nescafe before I fall asleep in the meeting."
"Instant coffee is just awful," Doris said. "I'm so glad I'm not much of a coffee drinker, or I would just die."
"What is wrong with Nescafe?" Zemaye said.
"It shouldn't even be called coffee," Doris said. "It's like beyond bad."
Zemaye yawned and stretched. "Me, I like it.
Coffee is coffee.
Later, as they walked into Auntie Onenu's office, Doris ahead, wearing a loose-fitting blue pinafore and black square-heeled Mary Janes, Zamaye asked Ifemelu, "Why does..."